I don't think he's looking for firewood, Jim. I don't think he's looking for charcoal either.
No.
I think he's trying to Minecraft himself a boat.
Yeah, he's he thinks he's trying to build a small boat to get out to a ship.
I think he's trying to build that. Because, like, he's wanting, when she's like, I gave you firewood, he's like, yeah, okay, I want wood, but I think he was trying to describe he wants bigger timbers so he can build a ship. I don't know if he's trying to build, like, a small boat that he can cut his boat out, or he's trying to build, like, a big enough vessel that... Because, yeah, I would imagine it would take, like a year.
Welcome to Bald Move Prestige, the officially unofficial podcast for Shogun on Hulu. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're back for episode 8 of Shogun, The Abyss of Life. This title's a little bit more cryptic, but maybe we can talk about it as we go along here. Aaron, what'd you think of this episode?
It is another incredible episode. It's kind of a bummer to watch because one of my favorite characters dies, you know. If you've been listening to the whole season, I've been looking forward to the Iron Fist to really Iron Fist some people. And his cutting out expedition in Osaka was pretty cool, but not quite what I was hoping for. And I didn't think that he'd Iron Fist himself.
Swordplay this episode for him.
I think it was last episode, or maybe it was on this last week's... No, we didn't do lunch. It had to be last week's episode where I was talking about the experience of watching Braveheart where... You know, I just watched, like, yeah, I was certain as a young man that this was all a plan and he's going to, and that's how I kind of felt during that scene where I'm like, oh, this is a way to get the generals to back down and cooler heads are going to prevail. And just incredible face acting I spent a lot of time studying. It's an incredible, there's all around Blackthorne had his, you know, met the 6-month-old version of himself and was repulsed. Mm-hmm. The most savage kill, though, must be said, was Mariko after her husband's tea ceremony. She just, this man. Wow.
Poor Bentaro. I mean, look, he beats his wife. He's not totally cool, but also, you know. That's pretty savage. That burn was pretty rough.
It is. Yeah, it's ice cold. It's ice cold. And, you know, and he gets a taste of his own medicine. I thought that was also pretty incredible. The Iron Fist, you know, essentially cursing him under the same curse that he's made his wife live. That seems some kind of justice. But I love getting to see Ito. My big question is, because we've been pondering this, like, you know, what is Torunaga's inmost heart? And I'm increasingly starting to think that maybe we're not supposed to like this man.
That's entirely possible, yeah.
We might admire him. We might say he's great. But good Lord, the things he's willing to sacrifice to do whatever his inscrutable goal is... you know, of like I'd already hate him if I thought that he was doing this purely for personal ambition, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But I kind of still riding with him because I think he's trying to serve the greater good at some point. Mm-hmm. What did you make of this episode?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I thought this was an excellent episode. It doesn't have, you know, a big battle or anything, but the intensity is just off the charts. That scene... with Hiramatsu committing seppuku is just, it's amazing. And the entire episode, I'm thinking, I'm sort of like these generals. Like, he must have a plan. He must have a plan. I hear him say these things. I see him do these things, right? Like sending the messenger back to Osaka. He wouldn't do that unless he had a plan. And yet here he is forcing all of his vassal lords to sign this document that says, yes, we're going to surrender when we get to Osaka. It's very confusing for them, but I constantly felt myself this episode going, no, there's more to this. There's more. Even when he's sacrificing these big pieces like Hiramatsu, you know, I still am looking at that going, there must be something more here. And you get to the end of the episode and you find out, yes, in fact, this was, you know, it wasn't necessarily part of the plan all along. He would rather not have had to do that, but it does serve his purpose for the plan that he's had going in the background. And I almost think I would have rather found that out next episode. People are saying this is a bummer episode, and I agree. You lose some big characters that we like. However, I think leaving us with that question of does he have a plan would have been a really strong ending for this episode.
Yeah, I'm wondering that too, because I did see a lot of people being like, you know, as great as this show is, that it is becoming increasingly this kind of really downer thing. This committing suicide all the time. The
bad guys seemingly winning at every turn.
Like by accident, kind of.
Sure.
But I do think it's all going to be worth it, you know?
Yeah.
I feel
the thing, like the stuff you said about Torunaga and whether or not you're supposed to like him. I still do think he's sort of pure of heart here. I think he is doing the stuff he's doing for Japan. And there's some stuff we can talk about with Lady Ochiba and her motivations and stuff that might kind of tie into that and explain why I feel that way. But I do still like the guy because I do think even if he's kind of cold in these moments, and but that's the thing, he's not cold. He understands the weight of what he's doing. He feels the impact of it. It's just he knows he has to make these moves in order to save the country.
Yeah, when he's building Ito from scratch, I think he also added another 8 layers to his fins. He's now 16 layers deep. But you can tell, uh-huh. Yeah, like that's, as I said, the incredible face acting and yes. The intensity, like when Hiramatsu finally did kill himself and his head rolled at his feet, like that 5 seconds where you see him mm-hmm. like go through all the emotions, you can tell it's not that he doesn't care, he doesn't feel, especially for his best friend, arguably a father figure to him.
Yeah,
it's just that he's willing to burn, he's willing to grind whatever grist the mill requires, it seems like. And until I know the intentions behind that, I just don't know quite how to feel.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah. That's fair.
But I do think that we'll get, starting next week, that things will start turning. Although I can't see it. Like, you know, I had this scheme, you know, obviously we talked last episode, I had like, he's either going to co-opt his brother and this was all part of the plan, or he's going to hammer an anvil with his generals in Ito and his men in Anjiro. And he's got all of his generals here. He's got his brother's army. He's got his army. He's got 49 days to prepare.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell is he waiting for? Like, what is the final, like a Blackthorn in his ship? But what is the clearly the value of appearing defeated is so that Asaka is, you know, like it seems like Ishido might be Twitter pated with his new bride or the wedding preparations, or I just don't know. I just like, why isn't it happening now? Like, and it's not just me wondering, it's like all of Torunaga's generals too. Like, yeah. I don't think they think this is a hopeless battle. So like, why does he need to play dead so effectively, I guess.
And if he already has a plan in place, what is 49 days of mourning by him? You know, because right. He thanks his son for that, and it seems genuine, but because he's alone there, he doesn't have any reason to keep those fences up. But I can't see it either. The only thing I see is, you know, what we talked about with Saki sort of being a double agent here, or triple agent. Uh-huh. I don't even know what you'd call it, but, you know, secretly they're working together, and he's being escorted back with this double-sized army that's going to just get in the gates and attack. I don't know.
Well, we're flirting with discussing the whole episode in the intro.
Yeah.
You got anything else you want to say, or should we get right to it?
Let's get right to it.
We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. Here's what's new in premium content for our club members.
This Tuesday, we're back off the clock with a new premium podcast covering our experiences with the new Amazon series Fallout, Alex Garland's Civil War, as well as some thoughts on X-Men 97.
Then on Friday, The Old Reliable, Lunch with Jim and Aaron. Join us in the Munch Crowd to watch us record live at 1 p.m. Eastern, or check out the podcast later that day.
If you want more Bald Move in your life, head over to support.baldmove.com to find out how you can get tons of bonus audio and video content, plus ad-free feeds.
And now, back with more Bald Move. We opened the episode with Lord Toranaga traveling the road to his hometown of Edo, now forming part of his son's funeral procession. We find out that the Lord's regent are going to allow him the customary 49 days to grieve his son under guard by his brother before they'll be forced to surrender to Ishido in Osaka.
Right away in this episode, I'm like, nope, not buying it. Toranaga's sitting on his horse, he's coughing. I'm like, nope, you're not ill. Bullshit, man. I'm not believing it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he is like legitimately a little sick and he's playing it up, or he's just affecting the cough entirely. Because I thought I caught him coughing in circumstances like I didn't when he rises at the end of this episode and goes and pledges to not waste his son and his friend's sacrifice. Doesn't he like cough in that morning too? Mm. Like, why would he do that? And then the rest of the, like, from that point on,
I
like the final minute. Didn't he? Okay.
No, I was watching for that second time around. I don't think he did, but maybe.
It seems like he's worried about a spy that he doesn't know about.
Mm, yeah.
Like that there's something. He knows Yabushiga can't be trusted. He knows Blackthorn can't be trusted the way he can trust his. But I think he thinks that there's another, or he fears, or he's just being uber careful. He's Michael Corleone-ing it because, you know, he did the same thing in The Godfather. Wouldn't tell his capo regimes anything, has just kept it between him and his dad until it's time to spring the trap shut.
Yeah, and we know that the madam over at the tea house and the courtesans, they're not entirely working to his favor here. Like that stuff with Omi, where they were just, you know, had loose lips when it came to Mariko's disposition.
True.
There. I feel like there are still some forces out there that are not exactly aligned with Toranaga, so he's probably smart to still play it pretty close to the vest.
That was really cool seeing Edo, his throne city, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
And it's like the one thing you are impressed by it is being under construction. Everywhere you look, there's like 30, 40 cranes, or, you know, they say the crane. Have you heard about that? The crane economic index, which is there's like an economist that have a shorthand for how healthy a city is by how many cranes you can count in its skyline. The more cranes, the rapid, like this is a multi-crane city. They went into some detail on the official podcast about how Edo was this kind of almost abandoned castle when Toranaga's historical counterpart decided to like make it his seat, and there's a lot of stuff in ruins. It's a very small village, but he wanted a kind of clean slate to build a model city. And Toranaga acting like he's given up on that dream, but you can see the beginnings of something great here.
Mm-hmm. I really love Yabushige ranking deaths, I guess. You know, it's the death is it's lower than boiling on the list. He thinks boiling is like right up there with the ways you want to die, but higher than being eaten by dogs.
So you see, my question is this like a golf score or a basketball score? Is he measuring dishonor? Is he measure the shameful way it's, or is he measuring the pain?
Or is he measuring what did he call it? It's not literacy. It's articulation. Maybe it's the articulation of the death.
Because I was thinking, like,
when you're being eaten by dogs, you're screaming. I mean, you're always screaming when you die.
What world is being eaten alive by dogs worse than slipping on a stone and,
right,
you know, going out in a few seconds?
You might be right. It might be about honor, right? But I don't know how boiling, you're getting boiled alive, is more honorable than slipping on a stone. I guess because it's not your own damn fault.
He said it's lower. Like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I don't know. But he's an interesting guy. Continue to... I'm so impressed by this guy. I looked up the actor, Tadanobu Asano, and I'm like, I wonder if I've seen this guy in anything. I've seen this guy in so much stuff, had no idea. Yeah. He was in 49 Ronin. He played one of Thor's three warrior buddies in all the Marvel warrior Thor stuff.
Okay.
He was Hogan, I guess, one of the Warriors Three. He was in the latest Mortal Kombat as Lord Raiden. And I've seen him in a bunch of I've seen every one of those movies. I feel like I want to go back and rewatch him just to see what I think of, because I just like this guy's kind of like my breakout star in this series. He's just even though he's what did Blackthorn call him, a shit heel or something, but he's just
shit face maybe.
He's just so entertaining. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I, you know, he's a weirdo ranking deaths, but I love watching him do it. Anyway, Mariko also gives Blackthorn back his logbooks. I think this is Toranaga essentially pretending to cut his leash, hoping that he'll cause some plausibly deniable little mischief that he can commandeer when the time is right. Seems like that's the plan.
Yeah, he's what, flying in from the fist? Is that the term? He knows what kind of guy he is. He said as much, exactly what he wants to do here.
It's a gosh.
And, you know, it takes him this episode of sort of meandering around, trying to figure out, you know, who he is now. But I think eventually he flies in the direction that Toranaga wants him to. Attacking the black ship will certainly ruffle some feathers in Osaka. Even though, you know, it's funny because Toranaga a couple episodes ago was like, that's stupid. Absolutely don't attack the black ship. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got all those people watching who heard him say that. And now, oh, it wasn't my idea. It was that old Blackthorn and Yabu. Like, punish them. Be mad at them. I'm surrendering.
I don't know what attacking the black ship at this point gets him. Like, it's got they got to be a month at sea. Like, even if the engine can catch him with his superior piloting ability, like, that's months away. You know, if you're gaining 20, 30 nautical miles a day on him, that's a lot of and the other ship sailing 100, 200 nautical miles a day. That's a lot of time to make up. So it feels like that he's going to my theory is that he's letting Yabushiga and Blackthorn kind of like plot their own destiny and make all the preparations to go to sea and fight. And then he's going to come in the last minute and yoink. Thank you for making all these preparations, my high admiral and my trusted samurai. I appreciate you. And it'll be all the kind of like, oh, I knew you were working, you know, they'll do the whole, I knew you were working for me and you were doing my will the whole time. Just like he's been playing Yabushiga the whole season. Just Blackthorn's going to get played like a fiddle this time too.
Oh yeah. Here's the other thing that I didn't think about until just now, because I think they want you to forget about it. There's that island out there with a bunch of wayward samurai, who have rifles. There's that whole army out there that's really well equipped.
The mercenary.
That's where the black ship went, right? That's what the captain of that black ship said. That's where we're going. We got to get out there.
I guess so. Yeah.
So that might not be very far away. He might not have to actually catch up, you know, as if he's going back to Europe.
So is that like, so you're thinking that those Ronin samurai are like the Sardaukar and Dune, that they're what Ishido is counting on to kind of balance the tide or turn the tide in case
it Toranaga. Could be that, or if they're just mercenaries, I mean, maybe Yabu can go out there and buy them. Yeah.
And I just don't know what's going on with Kiyama and Ono, because it seems like they're just hard set against him at this point, even with their Catholic benefactors trying to lobby in his favor. I don't know how much I believe that, though, on the other hand. The other thing I want to talk about,
I'd be
this...
curious to see how Christian they are versus how mercenary they are.
True.
That's what I want to know.
And they kind of set up in from the beginning episode all the Christian lords, or at least Kiyama is into Christ in so much as it lines his pockets, as much as he appreciates the blood sacrifice the Lord made on his behalf to free him from the bondage of sin. The other thing I want to touch on is how Mariko seems to be increasingly setting her heart against Blackthorn. She is just becoming disgusted at what a turncoat he is, and how much he just cares for his own skin, even though he's been that way from day one. I think she wanted to believe he was better. I can fix him.
Yeah. She
I
wanted
can
to
teach
change
him honor.
I think that's absolutely it. And he's just not getting it. I mean, every time he talks to her, he's like, you should run away. You should not, you know, be loyal to your Lord. You should save your own skin. And she's like, you don't understand. My allegiance forbids me from doing anything else. He just doesn't understand that fundamentally.
Also, it feels like his affections have switched ever since she didn't take advantage of the tea house opportunity and like doubled down on her eightfold fence with her husband and him. I think he's kind of like, all right, fuck y'all. I'm gonna go after Black Ship, make my fortune, get back to my wife and kids. So I don't even think like it, because that's the other thing, is I'm surprised at how much he didn't care that she was becoming disgusted with him.
Sure. Yeah.
But maybe I also thought that I started to see Blackthorn building up a few fences, though. So he's becoming more Japanese, a little bit more inscrutable for the era.
That's the thing. I think he's rubbing off on them. They're rubbing off on him. And now he's just a man without a home, you know?
Cultural exchange, baby. sure. So later that night, they've arrived at Edo, and Lord Torunaga's men are drinking to Nagakado's life, the recently deceased young lord, pondering the meaning of courage and the dangers of recklessness.
This scene reminded me so much of the second half of that Kurosawa movie we just watched, Ikiru.
Where
all these men sitting around mourning the death of somebody and just, you know, sharing tea and sake and speaking good of the deceased. Except it also has a second flavor to it, which is
this is more
to kind
fair
of rally
balanced.
The troops a little.
Yeah, because like Blackthorn, it seems like Bentaro is kind of interested, and I mean, you might believe this, that at least like, you know, hey, yeah, he was impetuous, he was young, he's a little naive, but you can't doubt the boy's courage. And he tells a story about his broken arm, and Iron Fist is the one that comes in with the boom and says what you know, the recklessness. And the other real big shift in character I saw this week was Omi.
Yes.
Omi seems genuinely shaken by, I think they were friends, they were peers. Like, I think he manipulated him a little bit because he's a little bit smarter, a little bit more cunning, but maybe feels a little responsible for the situation that he's engineered in large part, and he finds himself stuck in. But like, his entire affect is completely different this episode. And it started last episode where we started pondering death and how he used to have this nice life with a humble fishing village where he had the most beautiful courtesan in the land. And now look at him.
Right. Yeah. And Kiku was whispering in his ear. And I think now he doesn't have that. He's sort of adrift a little bit, and he's trying to find where his loyalties lie specifically. And here it feels like it's almost tragic in this scene because he's pushing these lords into resisting the will of their lord, and we see how that's going to play out here near the end of the episode. It's going to cost them some stuff.
And also, I think he's found a little wanting by Nagakado's courage and loyalty to his lord, because it's like, you know, he's kind of been playing this as a game. He sees what the game's cost, and he's like, God, would I, like, throughout this whole episode, he's essentially pondering, would I be that guy? Would I make that ultimate sacrifice? Am I going to be like my uncle? Do I want to be like my uncle? The next morning, the lords and ladies are kind of shocked to find that Torunaga himself is absent at his own son's funeral, which causes speculation on where the hell he is and what the hell he's doing, since apparently no one's seen him since they've gotten Ito. He's turned into a recluse.
But, you know, everyone has heard that he's sick, right? That's getting out there. That word is spreading. So
he's a broken man, Jim. Now his son's lost. He was already ready to give up.
He's physically weak. Yeah, he's got the cough. He can't even go to his funeral. My God, he must be on death's door.
Yabu looks around. He sees some of the Edo generals in their full armor at the protest, contra to Torunaga's own wishes. And he says, there's still a spark here. I don't understand why we're not doing anything. Why not march with our guns and cannon? And the Iron Fist Hiramatsu says, you are going to march to Osaka with our guns and cannons, and you're going to present it as a gift and terms of our surrender to Ishido, which I believe Yabushiga takes as a death sentence to him personally, because he's already
he's been called back, right? That's what Jozen was saying. Come back with us and you're gonna die.
I don't know if he can wriggle, like, I don't know what his angle, if he's actually going to go after the Black Ship and try to take it over and do search his fortune as a pirate. I don't know if he thinks he's going to do something so bold and brash and incredible that it's going to turn the Council of Regents back on his side. It seems like in the last he decided, well, I'm going to be loyal to Toranaga and I'll go down fighting. But
yeah,
going
but
in
I don't
just
know
to commit suicide
can.
Is, yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know if he can, because the guy at the wheel, you know, of that ship is Blackthorn. He's the guy who's going to take them where they're going to go. And I don't think Yabu knows all that much about sailing. If they're sailing north, maybe he could tell they weren't sailing south. But like, if he, you know, he wants to make a detour and a stop off at a certain island, that could totally be possible.
Yeah,
so he might find himself in the middle of a battle that he didn't expect.
Well, I think that's part of the subtext of what you're supposed to get from Blackthorn meeting his crew, is that Blackthorn is kind of a Yabushiga himself. He's willing to, I mean, he already has sacrificed one of his men to save himself from the boiling pot. So it doesn't always go well for his crews. He's not above lying to manipulate the, you know, I'm not sure. Well, I guess we'll wait to get to that scene before we discuss it. Nagakato's litter is placed on a funeral bier and they light it on fire. He's cremated, and unbeknownst to anyone, Lord Toranaga watches from high upon his castle walls.
Yeah, he sees the smoke. He knows what's going on, and I can't imagine that he feels anything other than wanting to be there. But part of his plan is being seen as weak, too weak to resist, and so he needs to avoid that. He needs to skip his son's funeral.
Yeah, to sell the kayfabe here.
Yeah.
Mariko inspects Toranaga's latest grandchild, and later that day, it's a baby girl, and it turns out her mother is Ochiba's sister. So Mariko takes the time to ask after her before being interrupted by her husband Bentaro's invitation to a private sea ceremony.
Yeah, tea. I didn't even know that was a thing, for pouring tea for your wife. I thought it was always the wife that pours tea for the husband, but apparently not. Or maybe it's some grand gesture that I don't quite understand the significance of. I understand it's significant, but maybe not exactly now.
Yeah, on the official podcast, they talked about that Bentaro's real-life counterpart was like a renowned master and was a student under this like tea lord, essentially. It was like the grand master of tea ceremonies in Japan. And that was a required part of the samurai. Like, you had to be proficient with bow, blade, staff, but you were also expected to be at least proficient in poetry, like these genteel tea ceremonies. I don't think everyone had to do everything, but it wasn't acceptable to be like the hound or the mountain in Game of Thrones, where you're just a brute, uncultured brute. And even Yabushiga, who is a pretty salty earth guy, aside from boiling people, you see that he indulges in calligraphy and poetry and appreciates the finery. That was part of the Bushido code. You had to be kind of like a warrior monk poet. So yeah, I mean, I got like on my watches that this was a very significant and meaningful thing, but they did go on great length. And they spent a considerable amount of time knowing that they were trying to portray a master at his craft, that they really tried hard to get the details right.
Anyway. That's interesting, because I wasn't sure, like, once we get to that ceremony, if this was him sort of like skin of his teeth managing to pull off this ceremony just right. If he had like, you know, been cramming the night before, like, okay, where do I put my feet and how do I bow? And I wasn't sure if that was it, but it sounds like he had trained for this for a long time.
And that's the thing. It's the thing when I'm watching Japanese do these kind of ceremonies is I am completely uncultured. So it's like, you know, is this guy an NBA pro or is he just good at pick up basketball? Like, I don't fucking know. There are also lots of false modesty. So you'll see a person and be like, oh, you pour amazingly well. Oh, I'm very sloppy. And it's like, Pontero apparently is a badass in the tea house as well as in the streets. So.
And as I understand it, it's the other way too. If you do a terrible job at something, a lot of people will compliment how well you did it.
Yeah,
which is really confusing. Yeah.
So while all this is transpiring, Blackthorn is prowling.
Hold on a sec. We didn't talk about the granddaughter at all. It seems significant, I'll say, that Toranaga now has a granddaughter.
I feel like he's got to have multiple. That's the thing. It's like, I don't understand, because like, I take it as a matter of faith, Torunaga, as a High Lord with all of his consorts, probably has just a slew of grandkids.
I would assume, yeah.
And probably a slew of sons. And I'm not sure why, like, Nagakato seemed like he was the only one. And
that's the way they're portraying it.
And I'm not sure if they're making a big deal about this as grandbaby. Is this his first granddaughter? Is it this just... It's unusual that Lord Torunaga hasn't gone and paid a personal visit. And it's selling the ruse. And it's also letting Lady Mariko kind of pump a confidant of Ochiba for information. And was there a little hint or a doubt in the back of your mind about whether this woman is becoming entirely forthcoming about the fact that Ochiba hasn't had any contact with her beyond just like, hey, you're gonna survive?
I didn't get that impression, but
I didn't either.
Maybe.
But it's hard because, like, I think my read is that Lord T's granddaughter here, daughter-in-law, well, he must be daughter-in-law because she's the sister of Ochiba. I was wondering because, like, she makes this face when Mariko kind of asks for information, like she's visibly uncomfortable, but it could just be that she's uncomfortable because she can't do what her lady is requesting her to do, and she's kind of embarrassed. But it's also impossible to read that versus a person that's embarrassed because they're wanting to lie, but it's not right to lie, and
they're not very good at it. Yeah. I don't know.
But Mariko seems to not be bothered because she says Ochiba's way of dealing with the difficult situation of being a highborn lady in Japan is to stay hidden, really bury that inner heart.
And one more thing about this scene, I will note before we get to the next scene, because it'll be too late then, Buntaro seems in much better spirits. Like, he has come to some kind of terms here with Mariko's relationship, whatever's happening there with Blackthorn. He's not over it, but he's not willing to go to his lord and say, I need this, I demand that this is dealt with anymore.
I think he thinks he's finally smiling. Yeah, I think he's finally found the way. Like, this is perfect. I'm going to finally give Mariko what she wants. I'm going to die with my honor. I'm going to protest for my lord's honor. I'm going to give her the best tea she's ever had in her whole fucking life.
We're all dead anyway.
This is what she wants. Is now finally what I want too. And we're finally reunited together, which is going to make it all the more devastating when that doesn't happen. So Blackthorn is prowling the streets of Edo for wood when Father Martine helpfully tries to translate for him. I don't think he's looking for firewood, Jim. I don't think he's looking for charcoal either.
No.
I think he's trying to Minecraft himself a boat.
Yeah, he's he thinks he's trying to build a small boat to get out to a ship.
I think he's trying to build that. Because, like... He's wanting, when she's like, I gave you firewood, he's like, yeah, okay, I want wood, but I think he was trying to describe he wants bigger timbers so he can build a ship. I don't know if he's trying to build like a small boat that he can cut his boat out, or he's trying to build like a big enough vessel that, because, yeah, I would imagine it would take like a year to build an English-style ship at the Japanese shipyard, even if he could find a craftsman and knew how to do it that style, or maybe he's trying to build like a Japanese-style junk. I don't know, but I think that's what he's up to. And he wasn't happy about Martine trying to help because he doesn't want anyone cottoning on to, like, I'm trying to. Or maybe he's trying to.
Right, yeah.
He also said that he needed a new bow spirit, the foremost mast, the thing that sticks out in front of the boat that holds the foresail. I wonder if he just is looking for, like, I need a big piece of timber so I can repair my ship. But he's definitely doing something nautical, not something household.
Interesting. I hadn't considered it, but now that you say it, yeah, he's not looking for charcoal because he knows the word for charcoal, and he couldn't find the word for what he wanted before.
Exactly.
Okay. Before Martine walks up, and then he's to cover, he's saying, yeah, I want charcoal. Like,
because that's the
really
thing. If you ask someone, if you go to someone in a village, you don't know the language and you know the word for wood, and you say, I need wood, they're probably going to give you firewood because the word you're looking for in at least America is lumber. You want to build something, it's not wood, it's lumber. So that's, he's asking for what? And he doesn't know, like, I need long firewood, or I need... I like it that he threw the cucaracha into Father Martine's face. or whatever the cockroach. I couldn't remember what the Portuguese twist on the word was.
La cucaracha is very different.
Yeah. Yeah. And he that's the thing, is as careful as he is around Martine about what his intentions are, he just announces, yeah, I want to get my ship back together and go after your black ship.
Yeah.
And Father Martine asks prophetically, will you wear those clothes? And what? I wonder what Blackthorne was thinking, because he kind of laughs and says, yes, I intend to. Do you think that he was going to impress his men with, like, look how well integrated, I'm plugged in, I've got a shipyard, I've got men, we could...
I think so, yeah. He wanted to convince them that this mission could still be accomplished, I think. You know, that he's... Because that's...
I've got the
flashback they do, right? The flashback they do at the beginning, in the, like, previously on... shows him in the pit with his men saying, this mission is not over, we can still do
it.
Yeah. So that's what I think is going through his head there.
So Father Martin's true business turns out to be with Lord Toranaga, who arises from his sickbed long enough to grant him a private audience. The outcome of the meeting gives Toranaga's men some slim hope that victory is still on the table.
Yeah, this is a little too transparent for my tastes. Requesting specifically that Martine go back and tell Osaka exactly what he saw here should set off flags in Martine's head. If he's not a complete dunce, he should understand exactly what Toranaga is aiming for here.
That's something you do in like an Inglourious Bastards context where you leave a lone survivor that you've committed atrocities against to go back and tell someone to terrify them of something. It's not... I am sick and old and I want to die in peace. Make sure you tell them everything of that.
Right.
You make sure you note how sad I thought it was a little heavy-handed too, but maybe
he could have explained
leaning
it
into
a little better.
The Japanese way.
I feel like if he had said, I want to like appease their worries in Osaka, please tell them you believe I'm defeated, right? Like you've seen how weak I am. You've seen how distraught I am. Let them know that this is real.
Honestly, I think
there could have been a plea there, but
the one misstep was he just shouldn't have told him to tell him, because
yeah,
I think Martine would do that anyway. What did you make of Father Martine being here under his own auspices?
Is that true? I don't know.
Well, this is something we've talked to. Like, sure. I think if I could lodge a small criticism against Shogun, that Martine feels fairly well underwritten. Like, the only thing that they're going off of is the father superior saying, what is it with you in this Minowara that he's got you under his spell? But, like, that's it. I don't understand why he's bucking the Catholic Church. Except for the other thing is, I think he's privately becoming disgusted with the Catholic Church. And but that's the thing,
because that black ship conversation where they were so excited to get the church made me think he could have some, you know, ulterior plan here.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like I know that they're essentially trying to sketch a trajectory of a minor character and then the passage of time. And you're supposed to like, OK, well, I saw him here and then I saw him here and I saw him there and all the dots connect. I feel like the dots are just a little too far apart, and if they had a little bit more time or a way to get back to his POV without just like, meanwhile, as they're plotting in Osaka, because it seems like they really want to stick with the POV of like Ishido and Blackthorne and only things that happen around them. They don't usually go to other locations and
A little more of Kiyama and the church interacting.
True.
That might have been a way in, because there are a lot of decisions up there and a lot of interesting stuff happening within the council that, yeah, aside from just Ishido and Ochiba, I would like to see.
He also is confused about why, like, he really wants Ochiba and him to ally, because he's like, I don't understand. This is all happening because she hates you, but I don't understand the source.
Neither do we.
Yeah, because they seem to be aligned in how they like the Taiko. Toranaga claims he's loyal to the heir. They both kind of are against the church or like trolling it. I don't see it. I don't see why she's afraid Or maybe she's afraid because if she knows that the five regents is a stable thing that she can kind of control and manipulate, but Toranaga's someone that she can't. Especially now that we see Ishido. Yeah. I think there's no way she didn't know Ishido had the hots for her.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you.
And she's like the female, she's the lady equivalent of Toranaga. Like, she is keeping all, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, Mariko told us as much. That's her way. She stays hidden.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because he suggests that alliance. I'm like, I don't think that's possible. Based on everything I've seen on this show, I don't think it's possible for Ochiba to drop whatever anger and hatred she has of Toranaga and ally with him.
She suspects him of plotting against her father, and honestly, I kind of medium suspect him of that too.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's behind it or he tacitly allowed it or agreed it, or he talked
about
it. Yeah,
just
through.
The plain reading of it there is she's pissed because she thinks that he and Mariko's father were plotting against him, which they were, I guess. So,
yeah. So, strangely, Toranaga grants the Catholic Church's land request, or he honors his end of the bargain, even though there's really no evidence that the Catholic Church. I mean, their plan failed. I don't know if they lobbied them at all, honestly. But he grants that, and Iron Fist comes out to tell the other generals, our Lord's up to something, I know it. He tried to pull that tell him everything bullshit, and that's just a dead giveaway.
Super obvious, yeah. Like, the fact that they don't realize it makes them look stupid. That Hiro has to tell him.
So Buntaro gives his wife a significant look at the end of the scene, which sets us up for this one where he serves his wife tea.
Yeah. Minor things. That bowl that she's drinking from is pretty ugly. This tea bowl. You've got these well-heeled.
Hey man, they lost their best stuff in a mudslide. Okay. You're kicking these people when there's
not an Edo. Not an Edo.
You think they got Pier 1? In this town yet that's being constructed. They don't even have a proper whorehouse. Come on now.
True. Yeah. All of their potters are out there, I don't know, slapping clay onto the side of a building. I don't know. Pretty ugly. But this is a beautiful scene, though.
It is.
How vicious it is, also.
Being an ignorant Westerner, the things that I got intuitively was this is something that he did that probably is not often done by samurai. They don't often treat their wife to an exquisite tea ceremony.
Yeah.
I got that it was a meaningful exchange between the two of them. I got that it was something that was very gentle and intimate and skillful. And then... Mariko, so I've been watching this new X-Men animated series on Disney Plus, and you're aware of
tie this in? Okay,
just let's wait. Go. Just wait, you're gonna love it. You know Scott Summers, Cyclops, right? He's got those ruby quartz visors. He can fine tune to let the optic blast, or he can just take them off and just hit you raw with the power.
Gotcha.
That's what Mariko did with the eightfold fence here. She opened up every gate and then fucking Dragon Ball Z'd his heart. And
yeah, it's brutal.
It is brutal. Like, because he is so convinced that he has done, he's found a way out for both of them. And she's like, you fool. I didn't just want death. I almost wanted a life in which you didn't exist, where like there was never any strings to connect me. That I was free to act in however I wanted. I could take this spear and I could shove it up a Chiba's ass, or I could. And he is just devastated.
As he should be. I mean, it's a brutal blow to him in a moment where, you know, his guard is down, right? Because he thinks, you know, she's been asking for this. She's going to be so grateful that I'm finally letting her kill herself. The thing is, I think what she's mad about is the patriarchy, right? It's been a point of contention throughout this season. And that is what she wants to be free of. Not Buntaro himself. She wants to be free to live as just another human being. And that is just not an opportunity afforded to her as a woman in the society.
I don't think you're wrong. But also, I don't want to underestimate how much I would say she hates Buntaro, except for she's deliberately not expending the energy to hate him. because she doesn't think he's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So like there is definitely like I don't think she liked Bentaro to begin with. I don't know why. He seems like he's handsome. He's definitely a skillful warrior. He was beneath her in terms of
lesser
marriage.
House, yeah.
He's a lesser house, but I don't think Mariko's necessarily that shallow. I don't know if they ever had a hope because he remembers their first moments as peaceful and happy, and she struggles to remember. But since then, she's just real. Like I said, I think she hates him. She's coping and fronting about it. Just so she can hate him that much more. But yeah, she really hates him for denying her an honorable death.
That too, yeah.
And he's going to get to live with that. Like that's the really delicious irony here is his father curses him to the same fate.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting turnabout later.
I did learn again from I was frustrated with the official podcast because the set designer and the person, the supervisor at this tea ceremony is talking about how everything had a meaning. The plant, the scroll on the wall, it was all of this stuff was prepared, like the Bentaro would have gone through the ceremony where he just meticulously cleans the room so it's pristine, like an operating room, and he puts all these things that have special meaning and significance to him and to her. But I don't know what they didn't actually say what any of it meant. It's just they were. And then they also show like how poetry is important to these people throughout this episode. Mariko is dueled with haiku. And I liked all that stuff too. I think I'm a kind of a sucker for haiku. It's peaceful and beautiful to listen to, but whew, Bentaro got emotionally seppuku'd at the end of this.
Yep.
Blackthorn tracks down his crew to a stinking pit of an alley in Edo, and he's not sure he likes what he finds.
Yeah, he's ashamed of his men, but himself more than anything, right? Because he realizes this is who I was when I first arrived here, and I find it disgusting. Because so much of the Japanese way, I guess, has rubbed off on him. He's somewhere in between, you know? He doesn't fit in their society, but also they've showed him a different path in life, and these guys certainly aren't living it, and he certainly wasn't when he got here.
Yeah, he's no longer nose blind to his own stink. After having 6 months of baths forced upon him, he's kind of gotten used to it. And, he's also sees himself as fundamentally different of these guys. These guys don't care about any bigger ambitions or, you know, fame, or they just want to get, you know, they probably just wanted to have a couple pounds in their pocket and their Dutch guildings or whatever the hell they call them and get back to their families safe and sound. And, you know, they've been probably thinking over the last 6 months, and they're not prisoners. That's the other thing that shocked me. I thought for sure these guys would be emaciated in jail or dead. But Toranaga's kept them alive, treated them well, indulged them in all the sake in the province, apparently. But he just realized he's just fundamentally different. He's more like these samurai. He's more like these ambitious men that have some kind of honor. And not only that, but the Japanese have started to build those eightfold fences with them. And I thought it was amazing he tried to duck the exchange. And it wasn't until this Solomon guy recognizes him that he's like, fuck, I got to deal with this pox-ridden fool. And ends up almost beating him half to death.
I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with life that lacks serious ambition. I think
sure, but
it's just the way that these guys conduct themselves. I mean, they're sloppy, they stink, they're look how they act when they're drunk, look how the samurai act when they're drunk, right?
we're aggressing upon women in either condition, it seems. But
well, Bentaro is an exception. Bentaro got a little bit too drunk, and he had the whole affair thing in his head. It's rough. But you know what I mean? Like the Japanese keep it together much more so than these guys who used to be him.
Yeah, these guys don't even have a concept of a face, whereas that's the most important thing to save in these more Eastern cultures. But he also just doesn't trust Blackthorn. He's been recounting events of minds like, you know, were we really about to be hemmed in by those Portuguese and Spanish ships, or were you just trying to get us to sail? And why do we go in this direct? Because of this? Or... And And also, like, you can't command me to do anything. Like, my allegiance to you ended the second the captain put a bullet through his head. So, fuck you. Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know what they're what they're so mad about, though. Like, the Solomon guy seems to act like they all got boiled alive. I mean, these guys are living it up by all means. They're given all the sake they can drink. They're out there doing whatever the hell they feel like, just not in their homes.
Yeah, I was wondering that because it seems like I kind of honestly had the same read. Like, what, you know, from my understanding of sailors, this is like their Valhalla. They're just there in a brothel, and they're going to drink themselves to an early grave, and that's what they do until they run out of money.
Big deal.
And when they sober up, they go back to the ship and try to earn more.
Being sponsored here by Yabu and Torunaga. Like, it doesn't seem like there is any amount of money that they need, right?
But there is a lot of things in terms of trust in the hierarchy of naval command.
Oh, sure.
And I just don't think these men trust him anymore. And they probably also don't like living in Japan. Like, you know, like in moments of sobriety, they must wonder, like, I wonder what's going on with my mom and my dad or my wife or my kids or my best mates back home. And I'm ever going to see him again. I can't even ask for anything because I don't understand the language. And you're just always going to be a ward of the state, it feels like. So I kind of get where they're coming from, but I honestly cared more about Blackthorn's reaction than...
Yeah, Blackthorn beats the shit out of this guy. He really doesn't like what he sees because he sees his former self there.
Do you think there's going to be repercussions of this? It seemed like his Japanese escort is like, we got to get to go. You might have beat this man to death, but...
I don't know how there really could be. I mean,
I guess the other men don't even know
now.
He was there.
Like, yeah, they'll never know, like...
Yeah, he's got a wadded up muddy kimono. They'll think he crossed some drunken samurai and got what's coming to him, I guess. Unless the other Japanese inform on him. And I don't even know if they know who he is, so.
Right. We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
After that disappointing encounter, Blackthorn's desperate to make his own fate, so we request a meeting with Yabushige and an offer to sail under his banner to make war on the Portuguese.
Yeah, Yabushige does understand controlling your own fate. It's what he's been trying to do this entire time.
He's a shitface, but he's a brave shitface.
He is. Yeah, and he's, you know, kind of a fool and an opportunist and... I don't know. He's right, though. I mean, he's measured this man, and he understands who he is. The thing about it is he also really wants to save face. And I think if, you know, Omi's not there and a bunch of other people aren't there to observe his treachery and weakness, he absolutely takes this offer.
I was actually about to ask you, if Mariko's not here.
Yeah.
So I think they're trying to also tell us a story that Blackthorn knows more Japanese now than he's letting on, and he's kind of Japanese-ing the Japanese the way they Japanese-ed him in the beginning, where it's like some of the translators know.
I'm very uncomfortable using Japanese as a verb in too many instances, but let's go with it. I think I know what you're saying.
Okay, maybe Torunaga. I don't want to say that it's because I'm making it seem like the Japanese themselves are duplicitous and treacherous. And that seems pretty racist. But yeah, they're Torunaga-ing
him. They're
taking advantage of, because I will lay that accusation at this particular Japanese man. He is tricksy and false.
Oh, yeah.
And that you know, I think at various points they made some hay that the various Japanese people knew a little bit more Portuguese than they were letting on. And now I think he's letting them underestimate him.
Yeah.
I think that scene with Martine with the charcoal is letting us know the fact that he is increasingly not needing a translator.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you wonder why he took her, because it's an open question. It's like, why would Mariko accompany him on this? And
you mean to this meeting with Yabu? I don't really know.
And he's got, like, that's the thing, is like, yeah, but Sheikah's got to know that Torunaga's going to know. Like, it's a crazy, the whole meeting is crazy that he brought Mariko. I don't understand it. Like, I understand why you want a translator, but like, why would he think Yabushiga is going to betray his lord right in front of his chief advisor?
I mean, she's been ordered to be his translator, so maybe, like, you know, she's Toranaga's spy with Blackthorn, right? So
yeah, Blackthorn's got to know that by now, right?
I just wonder if Blackthorn, you know, couldn't really get away from her. But
literally every other sentence that she has said in the last three episodes is, "I am loyal to my lord. Don't forget, I am loyal to my lord." Mm-hmm. So, like, it's just, I don't know, this meeting was a weird non-starter. It felt a little bit writerly to put them in a position where Mariko can just see the depths of his treachery.
Well, here's the other angle.
Or I guess
this.
Not his treachery. It's just the fact that he's just got the, it's like, the suicide, like, is by definition insane. Like, any option other than suicide, at least you got the hope of doing something.
Oh, and sure. I agree with him.
He just can't wrap it in. It's like, why? You're like, Toranaga giving up and all of his guys got to give up and die. And,
Well, here's the other thing to remember about Blackthorn is he thinks that Toranaga has completely cut him loose at this point. Like, he is a free agent.
And he has
so this
been,
isn't really. Which... Uh-huh. Yeah. So this isn't really like. It isn't really treachery. I mean, it isn't really disloyalty to his lord, I don't think. I mean,
not to
it,
him,
it would
but
be. It would be if he took the ship and went off and then, you know, disobeyed the order to kill himself or go to Osaka with him, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Gabu can't accept that order.
He's not asking for Yabushiga to join him. He's asking him to essentially... Yeah, maybe that's what he's asking. Because I don't think Blackthorn wants to be a pirate. And the only difference between a pirate and a privateer is someone with authority saying you can do it.
Sure.
So I think he's looking for a flag that will legitimize his piracy.
Huh.
And that would mean Yabushiga could like stay there and go with his lord, but like, yeah, here's my banner. I gave you permission. I'm the lord of the Izu province. Go forth and fuck shit up.
He's maybe, also desperate. Because otherwise, he's looking for any way out. I mean, it's his head if he doesn't figure something out. So suggesting this dishonorable action to Yabu seems reasonable. To him.
Yeah. And Mariko's handing out verbal ass kickings to anyone that wants in this episode because, you know, Blackthorn's increasingly desperate attempts to convince Yabushiga. And he's finally is like, you know, like, what sense is loyalty when the plan is senseless? And she's like, is that something you want me to translate or are you directing that to me? Boom.
Yeah.
Roasted.
That was just for you. I mean, he's been telling her that for a while now.
So Kiku's mistress, the Lady Gin, is inspecting her lands that she intends to build a great tea house upon. Simultaneously, Omi gets a little lesson in loyalty from a courtesan.
Yep. The juxtaposition here is really the beautiful part of this.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I do love the sense of humor on this show because this is a very Patrick O'Brien thing where there's this beautiful scene about loyalty and you see this old lady who's dreamed of this. She's not even that particularly old.
Not that old.
Yeah. Every episode, I'm like, God damn, she is. Yeah, Lady Gin is something else. Anyway. And Kiku's kind of, I can't tell if she was crying or if it was just a rain kind of misting her, but she's like, you know, showing this kind of reflected pride in her mistress who takes care of them and is looking after them and trying to build them a future and how that's worth your loyalty and your hard work. And Omi's kind of being shamed and then just violently left turn into Father Martin finding out that his church is going to be built next door to a whorehouse.
I love it.
And I'm just like, I went from like, oh man, this is profound to like doubled over in laughter at what a fucking troll Toranaga is.
Right. Yeah. He knew.
Father Martin's like, what? There's not a 500 foot rule in Edo? What?
No.
What's next? A liquor store? What?
I mean, consider it a challenge, Martin. You know, you got to change their ways.
Or
bring Christ to them.
I'm telling you what, I travel through the U.S. South a lot. I go down I-65, I-75. If you've made that drive, you will have seen the spectacle of one of the world's largest adult novelty stores I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And right in a parking lot next door is honestly the world's largest crucifix. It's got to be 300
foot
tall.
It's like 200, 300 feet
tall. It's lit
high,
up at night. It's just like Jesus is watching you masturbate. Like that's got to be a little synergy there, right? Like the Portuguese and Catholics are stumbling out of the tea house, and then they look and see, oh God, I better go and confess.
I got to think if Kiku and Gin turn around, they're probably thinking the same thing. Oh, we got to be right next to the church. All our patrons have to walk past there with their consciences and their guilt. No, we don't want this. So he kind of screwed them both, I think.
Yeah, it's like putting a window factory next door to a slingshot and ball bearing factory. You know, it's just like one is kind of undoing the other's work and one's manufacturing business for the other. And
yeah.
Anyway, back in Osaka, the Taiko's widow suffers a stroke and Lady Ochiba offers her comfort on her deathbed.
Daiyoin? Yoin? That's a hard name to say.
Yeah, Lady
she has a stroke. I was trying to figure out who this woman was. She's the one who was giving her advice about allying with Torinaga.
Yeah,
during
back
the
in the wrong horse. That rotten Ishido.
Yeah. And she's another one of the Taiko's former wives.
Yeah. And I think Ochiba has some kind of relationship, although I don't know to what extent, because that's the thing. It's like, the widow says, look, Ochiba, stop fucking playing games, release the hostages, stop fucking with Ishido, put a, like, on her deathbed, like, I'm, as your mentor, I'm telling you, this is the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, look after my son in the afterlife. And then I think she says it with a touch of pride, look at what I've made. And she's caressing Ochiba's face. And Ochiba feels what? Because inscrutable is the only word I have in my notes. Like, I don't know what she's feeling.
Yeah. I don't know what she's feeling, but I mean, the meaning of that is this woman has probably raised her, essentially, right? Even though she is roughly equal in status, because they're both, I think, courtesans or former wives of the Taiko. She's much younger. And so this woman has probably basically raised her and taught her everything she knew. So, you know, it has to at least make a dent in this mental armor that she's got, this resistance to Torinaga. I don't think it'll fully break down those walls. I don't expect them to form an alliance at all. But there's going to have to be some guilt and some soul searching that happens because of this.
Yeah, I think I accidentally skipped a brief scene at the beginning of the episode because I just realized there's nothing to build this on. But Ishido proposes a marriage alliance to Ochiba in this and confesses that he has loved her from afar this whole time. And I felt the exact same thing, that she was just inscrutable. I don't know if she's secretly pleased. I don't know if she thinks that this is a bad idea. I don't know if she loves him back. I doubt that. She's very much giving... Yeah. Heavily damaged, I can never trust men, I don't ever want to be under their power again.
I feel like she wants to rule rather than just be married to the person who's ruling.
She's a much better Cersei. Or seems to be, anyway. I really don't know what she wants other than to be maybe her and Mariko. You're supposed to understand them as two halves of the same coin, because they both want to be free of men.
Yeah,
and they're willing to do a lot of risks, including their lives, to ensure that for them and their family. Back at Edo, Lord Torinaga meets with his generals as promised, demanding that they follow him to surrender and sign a document pledging to that end. And the Iron Fist stages a bit of a protest.
Oh yeah,
if I could understate the scene.
Yeah. Sure. Man, what a scene. What a scene. I kept thinking during this scene, who's going to be the one? Who's going to be the one that's going to overstep themselves here and end up feeling the wrath of Torinaga? I did not expect it to be Hiramatsu. And this is the wrath of Torinaga. He doesn't want to do it, but he forces Hiramatsu to do it, because Hiramatsu is not a guy who will take back something he said and say, I was just joking, or at least that's my impression of the man.
I watched this scene probably 8 times trying to figure out what the fuck is going on, what was premeditated, what was prearranged.
I don't think Hiramatsu's in on this is the sad part. I think that's
But he was
Toranaga's
in on it
face.
at a moment too late. There's a moment where Toranaga and him lock eyes, and like Toranaga blinks and his eyes subtly change, and then goes back to Hiramatsu. And Hiramatsu's eyes kind of widen. He goes, so you do believe in pointless death?
Okay, I was reading it differently, but I could see it.
There's something that happened there. Because I think what happened is Toranaga was hoping one of his generals would commit seppuku and he could, or maybe several of them, so that people would be like, God damn, he's serious. And he wasn't counting on Hiramatsu playing his own little game, trying to his own pressure test. And once he did, he couldn't tell him to back down. He was now trapped, especially when so Iron Fist realized at the end, oh, he hasn't given up and he does have a plan, but now his selling his plan, I have to die.
And the crazy thing is, as much as Toranaga regrets that it was Hiramatsu who stepped forward to play that role in this, he's probably thinking, oh no, that's perfect. That's even better than I could have imagined, right? Because of all the people here, Hiramatsu is the one I think is the most costly sacrifice to Toranaga personally.
Yeah.
He's like a father,
And the whole, so you do believe in pointless death is a direct reference to the Tadayoshi situation where Toranaga said, people are saying he's brave and he stood up. He said, no, this is senseless. It's stupid. It's a wasteful death. And we know he doesn't. So, like, I'm using this kind of, like, double negative opposite day logic that, like, once that look between him and Toranaga took place, like, Iron Fist knew he had stepped in it. Toranaga knew he couldn't intercede. And that's why the emotion was so strong in both of these men, because they both got into this out of love and loyalty. And now it's costing him. Mm-hmm. It's already costed him son, which I kind of speculated he might have sent the son on that mission. Obviously, that wasn't true.
No.
And he had a plan anyway, and now his plan has a better chance of success because both of these loyal people bought him that time. And now what I do think he feels is that he needs to, he's even more committed because he can't waste this.
Yeah, I will not waste it.
I feel like he needed all eight fences to keep it in at the end because.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he employed every crane in Edo to build him more fences during that scene because he needed them, man. That was brutal.
The control he had, his face just became a canvas of emotion. Like, everything was going past his grief, this rage. Like, I don't even know if he was angry at Ishido before. That he was kind of like, if I'm going with the theory that Toranaga's in this for good reasons, I don't think he was even particularly angry, but now he's pissed. This has cost him more than he ever thought it would.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, he doesn't need to hide the emotion of this either, right? He can let his face read as devastated because he is. And it's almost better if he does let it read, because that will sell the illusion that, you know, his men will see that and they'll be like, oh, yeah, no, he is a broken man. Like, he's this devastated by it, and yet he doesn't stop it. That's how defeated he is.
I tell you who's really affected by all this is Omi. This, between this, the lesson Kiku taught him, seeing his uncle being unremitted, shit face in the face of all this adversity. Like, I think he's decided what kind of samurai he wants to be now. And it's almost like, like his own pride, like he'd be too ashamed to ever do anything. Like, I think he's really taking it hard. Like, what Mariko says is, like, freedom just to indulge yourself is not something that these people see as worthwhile. Like, what is a life if you've cheapened it through this disloyalty?
To speak to Omi a little bit, I think the temptation here is to assume that Omi has come by this newfound sense of self too late, right? Like, they're all doomed. It's not going to be important. I could see him being fairly instrumental going forward, though. with the relationships the way they are, with people around him not necessarily having the same conviction that he does, I guess, and him being shown as an effective influencer, I suppose. Like during that wake scene, that's all I can call it. I don't know the real word for it.
Right.
He's really convincing. I mean, half of the reason that Hiramatsu goes through with the seppuku is because of the words he said in that scene. He re-rallied the troops there. So he's fairly persuasive. And I think now that he has some kind of newfound sense of honor and loyalty, he could be instrumental later in maybe changing Yabu's mind when he's going to do something that's disloyal or dishonorable, right?
Interesting. Because I did think that Yabu is an interesting, he's not often inscrutable, but I'll use that term for him too. Like Aomi's just freaking out, the generals are losing their mind, and Yabu's just like, is he just cataloging like, another death, or
he's looking for how articulate Hiramatsu is during his seppuku.
Or is he trying to find I wonder if I can get in contact with the Anjin. I wonder if he's already set sail.
I don't know. He's kind of in disbelief in this scene. He's just like, is this really happening? Is this going down this way? Like, I'm not getting involved, but is this how it's going to go? That's crazy.
I know you're not in social media, but a really funny thing happened on the night that Shogun aired. Robert McElhenney, Mac from Always Sunny. Mm-hmm. He posted one of these generals' faces. You'll probably figure out which one and said, I got some questions for my... on my family tree, because this dude does look like he could be Rob's grandfather, like some kind of he's a World War II GI baby situation or something, because
really?
I'm telling you go back and watch the general scene and think which one of these looks like Rob, you'll get it right away, because it is, I didn't get it all on the first watch, but as soon as I saw the tweet, it's pretty funny. And also Rob McElhenney is a Shogun fan, who knew?
Yeah, apparently.
The other devastating, we talked about Buntero being a fractured man. This is another thing that just splits him down the middle when his own father asks him to second him. And he's like, fine, but let me join you in death. He's like, no, because fuck you and what you did to Mariko, boy. And it admonishes everyone not to give up on the Lord, even though he has given, it may appear that he's given up on himself. So he utterly serves all of Torunaga's designs, and I love the fact that he went into it not knowing what was going on, but I do believe he knew the score when he died, so he did it all. It wasn't like out of stupidity or what, he did it with a conscious understanding finally at the end of what his lord was up to.
Yeah, did he know exactly what he was up to, or did he figure,
no,
whatever.
Yeah.
I see that he's not relenting here, and I know that that must be part of his plan. So whatever the outcome of this situation, he almost puts his life in Torunaga's hands here. I mean, he literally does.
Yeah.
But in that regard, it's like, okay, he must have a plan here. Let me just see where this goes. And if it goes to my death, that must be part of Torunaga's plan.
Man, what it is, great scene. It's a gut punch, but when the Iron Fist screams silence to tell the other also elderly generals who are probably high up and respected, and they just instantly complied,
this is
God.
Between me and Torunaga. Yeah.
I thought he might, but then the other thing is I felt like the other thing, there's something happened with when the generals did the thing where they flicked his thumb and unleashed his sword, just kind of uncocked to safety, and Hiramatsu saw that and wanted to put the kibosh on it. But I wasn't sure if he thought that this guy was going to try to duel Torunaga, or if he's afraid he was going to seppuku himself. So he's like, well, Torunaga might ride, but he won't accept that from me. This will bring him to his senses. And that's the thing, is I don't think his generals.
Interesting.
I saw an analysis that someone wrote in a comment on Reddit, I think, where a guy was analyzing the situation, and he's like, the generals haven't given up in Torunaga, and they don't see their protest as disloyalty. They think that Torunaga is not acting like himself, that because of it, he's sick and he's grief ridden over his son, he's acting they think they're following his will because the Lord is not following his own will, and they're trying to recall him back to the Torunaga of old.
Yeah, absolutely. But
they just didn't know the real Torunaga.
Man, I'm trying to find the line from this episode that is all about that. So, something about can being loyal ever be disloyalty or something to that effect?
Oh, would Blackthorn
loyalty
says,
ever be a disservice? Yes.
Yeah, that's what Omi said. Omi talked. Omi talked about how he can't find his purpose anymore. Kiku says, "Well, you just need to look harder." And I think he's had a hard look and he's found it.
Yeah.
Also, it must be said, Bentaro is a stone cold badass. One clean stroke under intense emotional circumstances.
How ironic would it be if it took him like 9 jumps?
And the Iron Fist, you piss dripping boy, you know.
Right. Hey, man, you asked me to be your second.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was devastating. As soon as he said, "And you, Buntara, you be my second," I was like, oh my God. Because I know this is going to its conclusion.
Yeah.
Devastating.
Poor Buntaro. In the final scenes, Uchiba seems to consent to marriage to Ishidu. Then Blackthorn and Yabu are surprised to see Lady Mariko row, row, row her boat out to their ship late at night with a mission from Torunaga himself. Finally, Torunaga thanks his son and his greatest friend for their sacrifice, vowing not to waste the opportunities they bought him.
Yeah, so I'm trying to see the play here, because the scene right before this, the ending sort of or the I don't know, prologue of that scene before is Torunaga tells Mariko, yes, I do actually have a plan. That was unfortunate but necessary. Now it's time for you to play your part. And the next time we see her, she's sailing up to Blackthorn's ship. So what is her purpose here on this ship? Is it to ensure that they go to Osaka? Because Torunaga is worried that Yabu is just going to abandon mission and turn traitor on him. Is that why she's there? Or is there some other purpose?
I've been pondering that. I wonder if she is sent to parlay with Uchiba herself, or potentially assassinate Uchiba.
Oh, because Torunaga can handle the rest of them, but he's
because that's the one contrast they showed in their childhood scenes was Uchiba always sat out that samurai shit, where Mariko was all about it. So I don't think Uchiba has anything other than her intellect, her political instincts, and her guile to protect her. I don't think she could whip out a Naginata and start slicing people up the way Mariko does. And
yeah, that's an interesting possibility to either convince her or kill her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because Torunaga obviously sees the benefits of allying with Uchiba, and if he could pull that off, and maybe Mariko's the one girl who can, you know, maybe Mariko knows something about the situation that, but yeah, clearly she has some kind of
mission.
It's
her father, right? Was directly involved in that. Maybe she can feed her information that would change her mind on Torunaga. I don't know. That seems like a Hail Mary, but
yeah,
we'll see.
But the look at Yabu's face when he sees her pulling out there and realizes what's going on, like that Torunaga has known this whole time, and he's essentially requisitioning their ship as if it still belongs to him. Like, no hint
what's
of treachery, or you guys aren't doing what you're supposed to do. Like,
he's so confused.
I love how he plays that. And there's some written orders here, too. That's we don't really know. And I also got the... So Yabushiga seemed different than I've ever seen him before. Like, he's trying to talk himself in this Anjin alliance, and that, you know, you and I are partners and allies. And I think Blackthorn feels like he's got like 3 fences built, because I don't think he feels that way about Yabushiga. I don't know if Yabushiga feels that way about him, but like Blackthorn's going in his eyes wide open that this guy will probably try to fuck me or boil me in oil or otherwise screw me over if the second that it benefits him. And so all this ally shit, I see what it's worth. And Yabushiga, you know what it reminded me of? Yabushiga seems like he had the affect of when he's caught in a lie with either Ishida or Torunaga.
Mm-hmm.
How he's kind of this, you know, like the false is kind of happy, go lucky, unsure of himself, can't pin. There's a
playing dumb a little bit. Yeah.
And I think The other thing is, I'm pretty sure Blackthorne understands exactly what he's trying to say. He's playing a little dumber than he actually is.
Huh. Yeah, could be. I did think it was conspicuous here that he couldn't really speak a lick of Japanese when he's talking to Yabu.
It's also got to be significant that the Blackthorn's got a commandeered Japanese vessel that's almost certainly loaded with his fine English bronze cannon, and it's going to be sailing into Osaka Harbor with Mariko doing some kind of shinobi mission.
I'm curious if that's the case. So, yeah, I think, like, if they do sail into Osaka, that's a valuable piece to have on that particular board.
Yeah, floating artillery barge, sure.
I mean, but look, JB told Toranaga what that ship could do. It could go shoot down the walls, let your guys in. And
yeah.
And Saeki's only taking them as far as the gates. I mean, you got to remember that little nugget too. So once they hit the gates, blow those gates down with cannons and have your army rush in. That could be the end.
Especially since am I correct that Ishido still has no idea what these cannons are capable of?
No, I mean, they killed the only guy he had on staff who saw them.
That's what I thought.
He saw them pretty up close and personal.
Because that's the thing. It's like the Japanese might be completely unaware that a ship 100 yards off the shore could possibly direct accurate cannon fire to the castle.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. It's I see all the pieces. I see the armies. I see the naval weapons. I see Mariko as a very skilled warrior and a diplomat. I just don't know how they're going to fit together.
Let me ask you this. I'm recontextualizing. I'm sort of relitigating this ally thing that Yabu says. If Yabu is the Anjin's ally, that means they're going to attack the black ship together, right? Like, if he's allied with him, he's off Toranaga's page until Mariko shows up.
Did he? I guess my question is,
because that's the pitch he makes, right? The pitch is, let me sail for you. Let me go attack the black ship.
No, he doesn't actually say attack the black ship. He says, let me sail against your enemies with my ship.
Oh, okay.
He says that the Martin, and does this connect? Are we supposed to logically connect this to his other crewmates' experience that, like, Blackthorn's going to say, "Yeah, we're going to sail against your enemies," and Yabushiga might think Ishido or something else, and he's really going to, you know, hijack him and take him off onto the black ship.
Could be. Okay, that ally thing might not be as loaded with meaning as I guessed then.
I definitely think it's loaded with anti-meaning, because, like, these guys are not trustworthy allies. They're the short-winged goshawks. Goshawks?
Oh, yeah.
Goshawks?
I don't know how to say that. Ghost hawks.
Yeah, seen it in Wingspan enough, but... the final scene that we haven't talked about is Lord T rising in the morning. Jim says he's not coughing.
It's possible.
Took his Robitussin. Goes out, visits his son's ashes, and thanks him for buying the time he needs, him and Hiramatsu both, and he vows not to waste it. And this man looks hard and ready to get things done. As ready as Mariko was when he asked her if she's ready. He is ready.
I think you don't include this scene. I think you don't include the scene with Mariko where he's tasking her and letting her know, I actually have a plan. I'm not a broken man. I'm going to fight. And you let him get to the gates and you surprise the shit out of us.
Yeah.
I think this is a bad choice narratively.
Because I said that the last episode where you had Lady Gin, you know, kind of wink at the camera and say, don't give up, boys and girls. Toranaga's still in it. I don't know how I feel about that, because also I will confess that this would be a brutal 3-episode stretch if there was no hint that there was that he was up to something.
Well, hint at it. Don't tell us. I mean, they just straight up told us. I mean, Toranaga's literally saying it.
There's only 2 episodes to go. Like, do you think that this is going to be like The Wire, Game of Thrones, where the next episode is going to be the real hammer and then episode 10 is going to be a denouement? But I don't. Those denouements kind of like are satisfying in the context of setting up for another season.
Sure, yeah.
And this is a self-contained story, so like it feels like we have too much and not enough time simultaneously.
Yeah,
like it
I
feels
felt that
like
way about a few shows.
it feels like that there's no way that you can stretch a battle to two episodes, but also, like, how can you assault Ahsoka Castle in one? Or maybe next episode is going to be what's going on in Ahsoka. They're planning the wedding. They're secure in the knowledge that Tornaga's giving up, and we see Tornaga's preparate. But, like, yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that, it feels like it's too much time to stretch out. But then that would leave not enough time to have the exciting, climactic, thrilling battle in the end. I don't know. I think this show has been pretty flawless in its pacing. I know it's slowed down in the last weeks, but, like, it's not been uneventful.
No, it's been always super exciting at the end of an episode.
Yeah, not packed with action, but packed with things happening and important people dying. And I mean, I got to put the death count and the important people death count up there with anything. Game of Thrones, The Boys, like. Name The Expanse, name a brutal series, and this is definitely carrying punching at the same strength level in terms of that. I literally think anyone could die. In fact, I still am not entirely sure, like, if Toranaga survives, he might win some kind of Pyrrhic victory. And like a gladiator, I keep going back to that, like, he saved the realm but not for himself, but I felt more strongly about that when his son was still alive. It's like, I don't know how I feel if he dies to put the heir to, I don't think much of, like, his mother is a fearful, scheming person that doesn't seem loyal. His father was a bloodthirsty warlord. Like, I kind of want Toranaga to win for the right reasons, to save Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, man.
But it also feel like imagine the feeling of, like, you've been rooting for Toranaga this whole time, and he's on the throne or whatever the shogun equivalent is, and then there's some kind of hint that, no, he's actually kind of evil too, or he just did this because this is what he always wanted, or this is his destiny.
We finally see his third heart somehow, you know,
and it's something that repulses
us. Black.
Yeah. The way that Blackthorn feels about seeing his men after all this time, like. He comes to that would be a really interesting irony, that he comes to this final deep appreciation for the Japanese concept of loyalty and sacrifice, and then realizes that Toranaga, the leader of them all, is completely false to all of it.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm going that dark, but
I'm just saying,
you know, that's some 40K shit, right?
I do love a show that has me thinking that they might do the unthinkable.
Oh, yeah. No, anything is possible on this show, I do think. And especially devoid of the historical context, as I am ignorant of it, then I really do think anything is possible.
And really, anything from, you cited 40K, anything from grim darkness to noble brightness, and all that lies between, and probably all different shades in his men.
Principles. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the episode. Brother, you got some feedback for us?
Yeah, we got plenty.
Before we get to reading it, shogun@baldmove.com is how you send it in. If you'd like to keep up with what we're doing, follow us on social media. You can also got a great community on Discord, discord.baldmove.com. If you'd like to sign up for that, that's free. And then if you'd like to further support us, we could appreciate it. Support.baldmove.com, get ad-free feeds, extra bonus content, lots of stuff to enjoy there. And it helps us keep podcasting at the level we're accustomed to and you're accustomed to. All right, Jim, what has our mailbag got for us this week? We'll be right back with more Bald Move after this brief pause. And now, back with more Bald Move.
Well, we had to skip Nate last week, but he wrote in... get his words in this time with some stuff that I think was particularly interesting, surprising. He starts off with this word Yuuzhenji, which I think we asked about.
The still waters of the Yuuzhenji, the Saiki mentioned that's kind of made him soft and
manning those.
Yeah. Youthful.
Apparently the G at the end, the J-I ending, indicates a temple name. So it's a location named after a Buddhist temple, like this is probably a town or area that was named for the temple that's located there. And there's a few temples scattered around Japan with that name. So it's hard to know which one it might be or if it's just a particular place.
Does that mean that Mount Fuji itself is a temple, or is he being generalized here and G means like sacred place rather than, because, you know, it could mean temple.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, I know it has a place of importance to the Japanese people, but yeah, it's super, super interesting.
Yeah. And then he continues off with some surprising stuff. Someone mentioned the Age of Samurai Netflix documentary. Funnily enough, I'm one of the talking head historians that they interview, and I'm in all six episodes. It was a trip making it. It should be okay to watch now that the catchy stuff is out on the show. At least everything up until the last episode. So don't watch episode 6 yet. 1 to 5 happened before the time of the show, so for the most part, should be okay. Or you could just wait 3 more weeks and then use it to get your samurai fix after Shogun ends. Either way, it was cool to hear a project I was part of being mentioned.
Oh, wait a second. You cut the quote-unquote Bible of a historian that's featured on a Netflix documentary about this period because you didn't have...
Absolutely.
I feel like a self-respecting podcaster would have a sword out and his belly open by now. Like I wouldn't even have to ask. The shame of it. The dishonor.
I'm an opportunist. I lied with
you're much more of a Yabashige type, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got the pot boiling for me. All right. All right.
That's awesome
there,
though.
Nate.
Surprising and incredible.
Yeah. I'm always in Man, some shows we get like super high quality feedback. It's like remembering back to days like Westworld, where we have like AI researchers and philosophers write in, and now we have genuine Japanese historian, which he said, and that's like, I don't know why. It's like, because anybody can say it, but like being on a documentary,
being on TV, I saw him on the TV.
Yeah, any motherfucker can go and get a degree and be a dumbass
anybody
on the internet, but someone researched this guy and said he's legit, so.
Yeah, I trust television. Look, I'm the eldest millennial. What do you want?
Yeah, I've never heard of any lies told on television.
No. Speaking of projects, Nate continues, hard disagree on adapting more of Clavell's novels. Oh, I can't speak to the ones that take place in various times in China, but the other Japan-based book, Gaijin, takes place 250 years later than the events of Shogun, and as good as the bones of the Shogun story are, Gaijin is just hideously awful. I don't think there's any way to rehab that steaming pile of garbage.
Well, that's disappointing. And I guess I thought that there was a Clavell direct sequel to Shogun, or maybe this is it. It's just 250 years later. That doesn't seem satisfying.
Yeah. No, that is. That's what he's saying.
And I'm not sure if it's like a pile of garbage because of the way it treats the Japanese history. I'm not sure if it's a pile of garbage because of, you know, his continuing fascination of the sex and scatological stuff. But I will say that if that's garbage and the Chinese stuff is good, I'm not like a Japanophile. I would anything that's well written that involves intrigue and feudal, like I'm in. I watched a Korean zombie show set in feudal Korea. Like you make a good,
except
cool show
Succession.
With a great story.
Get
what?
That out of here. Except Succession. Get that out of here.
Yes. Okay. I'll amend it. I have no patience for rich and powerful people after Sigmund Freud. Once we had talk therapy and antidepressants, and you're a billionaire, just fucking go to therapy, man. I don't care about your bores on the floor. Go to fucking see a therapist. Mm. Go talk about your talk through your shit. But all the old people that didn't have it, I love the samurai. They don't have Prozac. Okay,
right.
They just got sake and slit their bellies open. So I respect that. I respect that. They don't have the choices we have.
Well, you know what Nate respects. He doesn't respect that Gaijin book, but he does respect something else. Instead, the production and writing team for FX Shogun need to expand out from the world they already have. He would respect more of this. I'm thinking of different events they could show us, kind of like Hot D does for the Game of Thrones timeline. At some point, I'll put together a list, but certainly could show us the rise of Kuroda in Tokugawa's youth, or the Taiko story, or go big and show us the invasions of Korea. There's way more I'm still thinking, but this is something I want to flesh out.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
didn't even think of that. I just start writing historical fiction based on the characters and world de Clavel. Like, you know, to adapt his work, you just take his characters and, you know, do the prequel stuff. And
Ishido and Toranaga, they were all involved in that Korean stuff. That'd be cool.
I could get down to Japanese Korean civil, you know, not civil war, but war. I don't know anything about that conflict other than it seems like the Japanese got their asses whooped and thrown back onto the island.
Yeah.
But, Joel is up next. He says, listening to episode 7 podcast, I'm about an hour 112 into it. And Jim just had mentioned he didn't know about the Japanese belief structure at the time regarding suicide. Seeing I've read the book almost a dozen times, parenthetically promises no spoilers, I can lend a hand at attempting to explain what I've learned. The book does a good job at explaining this via the internal monologue of each character, so you get a good sense of the general viewpoint on this from a variety of sources. The Japanese believe that when you die, your spirit waits 40 days, then you're reborn, and this continues as you live life after life until you reach spiritual perfection and then have achieved nirvana. This is would be the Buddhist Japanese. I know there's a lot of Shinto.
Yeah.
But it seems like a lot of the stuff they mentioned on an official podcast, like this cremation is a Buddhist thing. So it looks like a lot of the Japanese we're dealing with do adhere to that faith or Christianity. Mm-hmm. When you consider the time frame that was going on in the several hundred years of civil war, this belief structure would have been key at allowing people to be able to handle all the death that happened constantly. You would get your shot, and if something happened, you would die or commit seppuku and essentially get a do-over, kind of like reloading a video game and starting fresh.
That's great, man. I like that afterlife belief. There's no failing that afterlife. You have literally forever to get it right, you know?
Yeah, and there's a little karma, so it's like it encourages you. It's not free. Like, if you're a real shit, you get born in worse, like, harder difficulty level. Mm-hmm. And if you're a better person, you get born into a easier difficulty level. So there's still rewards and it's a roguelike. It's a roguelike where you get where you get the buffs and debuffs from the previous run applied to you.
I would definitely try and speedrun the afterlife, but
I don't know if all these game and comic book references are landing with the Shogun audience, but
I don't know.
Yeah.
Look, there's probably a lot of crossover.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Again, it's really hard to wrap your head around someone else's fiction, you know? Like, when I was a Christian, I could easily see how silly the six-armed, elephant-headed gods and the Scientologists and all that. But, you know, like, it's once you get out of that and you look back, it's like, oh, yeah, I had zombie Jesus who, you know, pissed wine and walked on water. Like, is that less ridiculous than, you know, so...
That's the thing. As a self-proclaimed atheist, everybody's an atheist. I just believe in one fewer gods than they do.
True. Yeah, very nice. And I realize as a believer, you're horrified by my belief, which is oblivion awaits.
Sure.
Or that I'm...
Or hell.
Pushing, so stabbing my thumb in God's eye and going to hell, eternal suffering.
That's what I like. You know, you can't really fail that. You get a chance. You get chance after chance until you eventually achieve nirvana. Let's go over to Robert, who says, has a question that I think we can help answer. Did we ever find out why Toranaga left as soon as they first arrived at Yabushige's province? From what I remember from the show, Nagakato just tells everyone, hey, my dad had to leave. I'm thinking your hope of Toranaga and his brother teaming up is correct with the plans hatched at this time. I believe he left to go get that army that got decimated by the landslide. Earthquake.
Yeah, on the face of it, he went to raise his banners and left, I guess, enough garrison in Edo to protect it because he doesn't want his hometown sacked. Yeah. But you might be right. There's nothing saying that Toranaga couldn't have killed two birds with one stone.
Oh, yeah.
Especially
in fact,
if one of the
I'd almost
one of
be
the
disappointed
birds
if he hadn't.
Is carrying a message to his brother, and he doesn't. Because I was like, "Well, how's he going to march? How's he going to take the?" Because they make it clear that his brother's living in the Osaka province or whatever. Osaka's the city, whatever province. Like, he's there, attached to the capital. It would seem crazy if Toranaga went there himself, but obviously he has a bunch of vassals. He's got spies. He's got birds.
Mm-hmm. I want to know about this bird messaging system a little bit more. Like, the birds don't go right to the loyalists' houses. Like, they go to a central location, I would assume, right? And Toranaga's going to send birds in and just trust that nobody's going to read his secret messages?
So I think the way carrier pigeons work is they are raised at a particular roost, and then their instinct is to, and they got this crazy homing ability, and they can unerringly to wherever you take them. So the idea is you raise birds at your roost, and then you take those in cages to the people that you want to be able to communicate with you, and vice versa. And then those birds are held there against their will. And you tie a message to them, and as soon as you let them go, they're like, oh, fuck this, I'm going home, which is back to the castle where they came from.
Directly to the window where the roost is? Wow.
Yeah, okay. I think that's, and they did that up until they went extinct in World War I when they killed so many of them in the line of duty. Thank God we had the telegraph ready to go, ready to replace nature with the cold machine. Doug says, longtime Baldy here. Oh boy, we're gonna have a Trekker Trekkie fight here, because there's I've never heard Baldy. I think Mover is what a lot of people are using, some movers, but Bald, it's not inaccurate. At least I've lost a lot. Jim still has a full head of hair, the bastard, cutting historians' Bibles and having a full head of hair.
Need a haircut.
As someone who lists, oh, really? You have too much hair? Is that your fucking problem?
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
I can't deal with all of it.
I see. We're hurting our host today. As someone who's listened to the entirety of Game of Thrones.
You poured me tea. What do you want?
You blasted me through your ruby quartz fences. Jesus. Anyway, long-term Baldy, watched Game of Thrones a bunch. I've grown an affection for Aaron's accidental name mispronunciations. Oh, boy. This has been a real garden of earthly delights for you, I'm sure, Doug. Latest episode is when he called Kiku kooky. Did it again. ran it back. It reminds me of a mistake my friend and I once made with hitchhiking around the island of Shukoku for the 88 temple pilgrimage. This pilgrimage follows the footsteps of Kodo Daishi, also known as Kuke. Ku like in cool, and Kai like in Kyle. Kukai. Thank you for that, Doug. The founder of the Shingon sect of Buddhism. During our trip, we loved to test out our Japanese whenever we had a chance to talk to the locals. One time along one of our rides, I remember my friend and I were talking to the driver and kept asking about Kukai. And he kept looking absolutely puzzled with what we were saying. We explained, you know, Kodudashi. And the guy laughs and says, oh, Kukai. Turns out we've been calling him Kuki. The whole time inadvertently. We get a good laugh from it to this day, but when I hear you call Kiku the courtesan kooky, it makes me laugh even more, thinking about those fellas spending the night seeking a path of enlightenment to Kukai.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't know Japanese, even. That's my big problem here. And I butcher my own language, so you can imagine the mangling I do in foreign tongues, so...
No, it's been really a struggle to get all these names down and remember them, because some of them are very similar too, and that always becomes an issue for me.
Yeah, and especially they're strange, because like I've got dyslexia, and a lot of times I transpose syllables and stuff, and that's when I know when the syllables, you know, But when I don't even know like how they go, they're supposed to go. Like that's why I was like taking the back half of Nagakado's name and then mashing it with Toranaga and his Toranaga. It's like, oh god damn, it's really frustrating. But I'm glad it amuses people. It's free comedy.
It seems to be endearing, so that's good.
Yeah. That's how I skate by. That and spell check.
All right, Chris L. says, as a recent book reader, this adaptation, in particular the last couple of episodes, has remixed past the point of comfort for me.
Uh-oh.
I'm committed to seeing it
to
its conclusion.
Have you tried pillowing, Chris? I've heard that makes you more comfortable.
Oh, yes. But even as a book reader, I have no idea what the fuck that's going to look like, the conclusion of this. Hopefully something more satisfying than the Game of Thrones finale fiasco. Yeah, I can't imagine it would be less satisfying given the storytelling to this point. And it's just pure adaptation. They don't have to riff too much. So Aaron was pondering Mariko's position on suicide last week, as her desire to end herself would seem to conflict with traditional Christian values. I believe he proposed that she may employ some sort of syncretism. Is that how you say that word?
Yeah, syncretism.
Or is it
think?
Okay. Using Christian teachings as her blueprint, but adding or subtracting according to strong cultural beliefs and ideas. The book makes it clear that this is indeed the way that Mariko rolls. She seems to believe that God, through the work of Jesus Christ, is ultimately the savior of souls, but that when it comes to matters of daily life, her lived cultural experiences and social duties supersede what the Bible would commonly be understood to teach. There's not only an appropriate time for suicide in her worldview, but for many activities generally frowned upon by the church at large.
Honestly, I can think of nothing less Christian or more Christian than to pick and choose what you're going to go,
right?
What you're going to roll with based on your lived experiences and what you're comfortable with, you know?
I mean, isn't that what Christianity is basically is a just a mishmash of a whole bunch of religions as the Romans went across the land conquering civilizations? They're like, well, we don't want to piss these people off too much. Let's give them their part in our religion.
It's a big tent Christianity.
Oh yeah.
Rather have people pissing out than pissing in, you know?
Sure. Chris goes on, one interesting change I noticed in last week's Stick of Time episode is the scene in which Torunaga insists that Mariko must choose between her duty to him and her duty to the barbarian. In the book, this statement is aimed not at her loyalties to Blackthorn, but at her loyalties to the church. Torunaga is worried that Mariko will not be able to remain loyal amidst moves he may need to make to the detriment of the religious cause. She assures Torunaga that this will never be an issue. Yeah, so they're really remixing that stuff to the point where I don't even necessarily feel like that's a spoiler, because Torunaga has not really given much concern to Christianity this entire time. It's more been Blackthorn as like, yeah, I will go attack these Christians.
That's the other surprising thing in this three-episode downturn for emotional downturn for a series is what I once was like, I was really shipping Mariko and Blackthorn, but like that ship feels like it sailed. It feels like that is dead as disco. Like, I don't feel like and especially two episodes left and a whole war to fight, I don't know how you give them a romantic happy ending.
And like, it feels like the ship, the last nail in that coffin, is actively sailing right now, like literally sailing.
Yeah.
Because if he's going to go attack the Christian trading ship, I can't imagine she would appreciate that much.
I don't think he's going after Black Ship.
No? Okay.
I don't know how that serves. I don't know how that serves Torunaga's. Like, he might do, like, he might be sent out at the end of the finale episode, but you know, who knows? Like, but Taro could die in this battle, and she could vanquish Ochiba and still be left miraculously alive, and her and Blackthorn are there, and
I just know that that's a piece still on the board, this island, and that's where the Black Ship was headed.
Mm-hmm.
And they have really conspicuously not talked about it for a few episodes.
Yes, they're hoping we forget. RCM. There's an old Japanese saying that goes like this. Honestly, don't spend too much time parsing the words of a warlord who chooses a child as a second. Is that literal? CM taking
can't
the piss?
Be literal. Okay. Yeah, no way. So.
Especially honestly, gives it away. It's too informal. It served me well in life. I'm pretty sure it wasn't this guy's first bad decision. As for Mariko, Fuji, and their death wishes, I understand it this way. They each have their two duties. One duties to their families, the others to their liege lord. Leal to their liege lord. Torunaga understands this, but also understands that he can only push the second duty so far, which is why a discussion about how long Fujiko will serve Blackthorn was a negotiation. He knows if he tries to force her to serve him for 2 years, she'd just kill herself. To me, Torunaga is one of the few people who understands and appreciates living. As long as you are alive, there are possibilities. Some of the others are too eager to kill themselves for whatever reason. That's interesting that there's some kind of implicit timetable. Like, I'll endure this drowning alive for a little bit longer, but if you tell me straight up I'm gonna have to live for 1,000 years to do, then yeah, I'm fuck it, I'll deal with the shame.
And Mariko has been enduring it indefinitely. She doesn't know how long she'll live, but
yeah, just with the vague promise that you've got a mission to fulfill. Your dad told me.
Yeah,
dad said honest to gosh. One more comment about Blackthorne. In the book, he becomes more Japanese over time and becomes more respected. However, in the incarnation, in this incarnation of the story, aside from stomping into every scene, literally and figuratively, he's got the hair and voice thing going on. I can understand why they still consider him a barbarian.
And this his hair, yeah, he's so shaggy.
It is pretty, yeah, it's not, it's shaggier than even you, apparently. Plus, it's just completely unkempt. He's doing nothing with it. He's not styling it. It's just a bird's nest.
It's all one length. Yeah. There's
And the bird has died and has been hanging outside a cabin for 7 weeks.
And it stinks.
At this time, I disagree with Jim. All right. The robe Tornaga's brother was wearing, along with his other outfits, was spectacular. Who would want to mess up that robe by killing someone? Tornaga's son, fully cocked or not, knows a good robe when he sees it. I think he hesitated because he's going to ask him to please take it off before killing him. Unfortunately, fate stepped in. Yeah, you got to respect the drip. The meeting with Blackthorne and his quote-unquote men is another example of a minor deviation from the book. He met with all of his men in the book in the previous series, but man, it took some big turns in this episode. Not sure if he'll like them all in the end, but this episode kept me on the edge of my seat. R.I.P. Hiramatsu. Once he committed from a storytelling point of view, I'm glad they didn't repeat the early scene of Blackthorne's aborted seppuku. However, I have to be honest, I was hoping they would. Another powerful chess piece off the board. As I mentioned in my first email of the podcast, Tornaga knows the true value of the pieces and is not afraid to sacrifice them when in need. I guess they substituted Hiramatsu's death at the other loyalty test in the book that involved his son. God damn it. I really want to watch the original miniseries and then read the book. Which order do you think I should read them in? And are you interested in doing that with me and prolonging some Shogun content?
Oh, yeah. What if we did? Well, I was going to suggest, what if we watched the original miniseries?
We could watch. Yeah, there's no way we could finish the book. It's like 1,200 pages. There's no.
Oh, in, Christ.
Like,
okay.
Yeah. But the miniseries is, I think, 6 hours. I think we could do that and have like an interesting little comparo discussion that might be interesting. And then, I don't know, maybe I'll kick the book discussion to OTC to make you freeloaders pay. If I'm gonna read a phone book, $5 a month, you can. Yeah, I think we can do that. Yeah,
like I said, 600 months to get through it.
Because I also know we're heading headlong into the busiest. It's our Super Bowl. House of the Dragon is our Super Bowl, and we got a limited time to prepare for that, and a bunch of irons in the fire. So, but
you're right about this. I think like the reason this is such a gut punch is because we liked him so much, right? I'm with you. I felt this death.
I was willing someone, and like as the generals start getting more agitated, Naomi's like, Lord, this is Matt. I was like, there's got to be a way out of this. Like Tornaga's going to say the Japanese equivalent of psych. That was just your loyalty test. And I want to see who was, I was trying to smoke out the last traitor.
Weed out the other one. Yep. But no, it's real. And I'm trying to, I can't even think of a single other character, Mariko, maybe, that I would feel this way about their death and this tensely about their potential death.
I would be devastated.
Mariko, that's it.
I'll be devastated when Yabushiga dies because his entertainment value will be over. I mean, fair. I might get a little emotional.
All right.
Yeah. Like my hatred of people being boiled alive is really being tested by this man's charm.
And that was so long ago. I mean, maybe he's changed.
Blackthorn's
maybe he wouldn't
rubbed
boil,
off on
man.
Him a little bit. Yeah.
Making a lot of excuses.
I can fix him.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's move over to JJ Johnson. I'm listening to the Shogun book on a service that back in the day advertised on the Ball Move Network.
Back in the days where podcasts were getting $50 per CPM. they pay you to say use this service. Those are salad days, it turns out.
He's trying to stay just 1 week ahead after every episode airs, though.
That's
my guess.
Tickling the old dragon's tail, my friend. Oh boy.
Sometimes reads too much, sometimes too little. Yeah. The plot of the book has matched the plot of the TV show amazingly close. That is, until last week's A Stick of Time. Seems like everybody is getting stuck on A Stick of Time. The overall path of the plot looks like it is headed to the same place, but events have radically departed from the book. I know the showrunners had to cut out a lot to take a 40-hour book and condense it to 10 hours of TV. Here's the crazy thing. TV plotline is now better than the book. This almost never happens when a book is translated to the screen. The only example I can think of is the 90s movie The Firm. The ending of the Tom Cruise movie was far better than the ending of the John Grisham book. Oh no, does that make you not want to read 1200 pages if this plot is better than the book?
I don't know. It seems like that might be a minority opinion. I think the
details would be super interesting regardless.
Most book readers seem to be very pleased. I've been talking with our buddy Pete Peppers on YouTube, and he's a big fan of the book, and he's pretty over the moon with it. By the way, check out Google Pete Peppers or just search for it on YouTube. He's got a whole in-depth series, and he's not spoilery, but he does, you know, got that like really good book reader foundation, and he does really great work. But
yeah, really analytical stuff too, where he's breaking down what each of these actions means.
Even in the heyday of Game of Thrones, like, I don't know if you want to call it season four is where the, you know, season five is where it went bad, season six where it went bad. But like even they would, I think I would definitely say seasons one through five are skillful adaptations. And there's a lot I liked about five as well. A lot of I liked about six. The wheels really started falling off after that. But they still changed a lot to streamline and to do it. I mean, I think that's part of a skillful adaptation. It's very rare that they do a better job than the books. I'm struggling to think of a movie that I definitely, there's a lot that they did justice. Like, you know, Peter Jackson, I think, did real justice to the Lord of the Rings. The closest I can think is like maybe The Godfather, because that book has everything that makes the movie great. Like everything is there, like right on the page.
Maybe The Expanse. I've read the first six books to completion of The Expanse. I think the TV series does some remapping that services characters slightly better.
But Dan and Ty were the executive producers in the writer's room. And I think they're essentially saying like, we kind of fucked up by doing it this way. Yeah. Let's thread this a little bit better.
It's a little bit of an asterisk there, but yeah, that was a great show.
Three Body Problem. The TV show is so much better than the experience of being an English reader reading that translate. And I know, again, maybe in the original Chinese, it's a lot better, more poetic. Maybe if you're a Chinese national, you'd understand some of the cultural references a little bit better. But boy, howdy. Speaking of the double Ds in Game of Thrones, I think they're good at adapting difficult works. They're less at writing their own stuff. Chris from Toronto, Lord Toranaga would really make an excellent wall facer. He's almost operating like one throughout the series. How?
Speaking.
How do I have such seamless transitions from topics? I didn't even know that was coming. Like, got the three body problem reference, and now we're doing wall facers. See, that's why it's worth the $5 at support.baldmove.com. Because you should see what we get up to on lunch.
It's all segues. That podcast is all segues. Yep.
Nothing. It's like,
there are no topics,
you know,
just segues.
Right. It's like when you go to see a show and it's like a juggler. It's like, really? An hour of juggling? But then the other thing is like, must be a pretty fucking good juggler, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I've heard of comedy torture, never juggling torture. But I could see it where I'm so like, oh my God, I'm over this juggling. And by the end of it, I'm way back on the side of the juggler.
Yeah, yeah. Like at the middle point, you're like lost.
It's
just
an endurance thing.
Desperate to see anything but juggling, and then he brings it back around, ties it all
like
up into a bow.
I'm sitting there, I'm watching him juggling. I start moving my hands like a juggler would, going, "Can I keep this up for an hour? I don't think I could. That's damn impressive."
I don't think it's an effective ad. I feel like 100 people unsubscribe for our Patreon.
Look, it's the end of the podcast. No one's listening anymore anyway.
Them's a risk you take with the segues. Support.baldmove.com if you do want to throw your good money after bad. Check us out on social media at Bald Move everywhere. And Shogun at baldmove.com if you want to right into the podcast. Thanks for listening to another action-packed week of Shogun. Again, I cannot wait. Be very careful. I've heard that the synopsis of the episodes that are live on Hulu, including maybe even the titles, are a little spoilery. Now that we're getting closer to the end of the playlist, it's getting harder and harder to keep your eyes from darting to those corners. Be careful. Try to stay unspoiled and come back next week. We'll find out what's happening. What's going on in that third heart of Toranaga Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Take care.